Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, CA. An author named Pete Daniel has written a remarkable new book. Its title is Lost Revolutions, and it's about the American South in the 1950s. Now, this is the South of blues and country music, of NASCAR racing and moonshine making, of rock and roll, rebellion, and resistance. Most of all, this is the South of lost chances, when bigotry and cowardice too often trumped courage and conviction, in a place where race, sex, and class met in deep swirling currents. It's a Southern story, yes, but it is most resonantly an American story. My guest is Pete Daniel, author of Lost Revolutions. Pete, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George.
Pete, I think is already very clear. I was profoundly affected by this book, and so I'm delighted to talk to you about it. I'd like to start with the cover itself, which is a very evocative form of cover art. B.B. King and Elvis Presley stare out at us from the cover in a large image photograph, both men smiling and sort of standing next to each other. But then in a sepia-toned, smaller inset, we see the same image repeated, this time with Elvis Presley's arm around B.B. King. And I took that as kind of metaphorical, and a sense of the parallel and twinned and intertwined destinies of black and white Southerners.
I hope that message comes across. The segregation is such a major part of this book, and trying to deal with the complexities of people's thoughts on segregation. And Elvis Presley and B.B. King, of course, are two of the great musicians of the century. And they knew each other, they liked each other, and in this particular picture, they were at a Goodwill review sponsored by the black radio station in Memphis, WDIA. The man who took the photograph was Ernest Withers, a man who had been one of the first policemen, black policemen in Memphis, a wonderful photographer who covered the South during the days of civil rights. He has wonderful photographs and is only now, late in life, getting the proper credit for what he did.
Now, to go back historically, Pete, as you do in this book, I was struck by the pivotal importance of 1945 and kind of the end of World War II, and, of course, World War II and the Depression, which had preceded it, and the number of challenges, if you will, to the Southern way of life that were being presented. They struck me as being both legislative and technological, and even included significant migration patterns. Now, do I get it right? Was that really a sort of a threshold period?
I think it was a moment of great opportunity. People from the South who'd gone off to war, gone off to defense factories, had learned things they would never have learned in the small towns and farms where they came from. And it was a moment when technology and agriculture was turning people off the farms, when government programs were turning people off the farms. But people were fairly optimistic. And a lot of people who'd gone off to war, black and white, learned that the narrow restrictions of their lives under segregation were no longer acceptable, nor were the houses they lived in without plumbing and all the other inconveniences they suffered for being poor in the South.
You know, as a reader, Pete, I got the sense that the South was essentially meeting the world in those years. I mean, by kind of this out-migration of its sons and daughters through the war, that what had been certainly a singular culture, but also kind of insular culture, was being subjected to these, as one person later puts it, outside winds, so to speak.
Yes, Southerners were interesting in their reactions to the outside world. They learned a great deal. But I would also venture that the outside world learned a great deal about Southerners. Some of it was almost poisonous when they turned on the segregationists, when white people talked very harshly about their black neighbors. But in other cases, it was a time of great opportunity.
Pete, let's go to the heart of this, because I think this is the heart of the book, the codes of segregation, the promotion of what I think the book refers to as a Southern mythology, which, of course, the Lost Cause and all that had been promoted for some time. But as you point out in that answer, this really gets to be the dominant theme, doesn't it? I mean, this is the message that gets made the theme of the day throughout the South for all this period.
Yeah, segregation, I think there was kinds of segregation all along, but in the 1890s and turn of the century, of course, it became legal segregation. And as the system went along, whites were told that this was God-ordained. It became almost religious in their minds, inseparable from their religion.
Right.
And by the time you get to the 50s, politicians have seized on this for a half century, and they are not about to give up this issue, which they can usually ride pretty far into getting elected. And this is one of the lost causes, is the Southern politician century. And they are not about to give up this issue, which they can usually ride pretty far into getting elected. And this is one of the lost causes, is that Southern politicians just did not take any leadership in getting rid of the segregation cause. No rival group to the Dixiecrats among white politicians ever emerged.
I think you actually extend the indictment, Pete, because you're absolutely, I'm not telling you about the book you wrote, but it seems to me you do make that point very powerfully about this failure of Southern politicians. But do I get also the impression it was also a failure of the white middle class to sort of step forward in this way? Of course, misled by their politicians, but it was sort of the elite level of the Southern system?
That's an interesting question, because the middle class was silent. As far as taking a stand, they were most of the time silent. Mm-hmm. The citizens' councils, who were white leaders, businessmen, were very much for preserving segregation. And they made it almost impossible for other whites to come out against them. They would boycott them. They would isolate them within communities.
Right.
If you came out for integration as a white Southerner in the 50s, you paid a price. Yeah. But there was no organization among the probably, I'm not sure how many people there would be, but a lot of people who really didn't believe in segregation anymore.
Yeah.
They'd gone through the war. Mm-hmm. They had misgivings. They would have welcomed leadership that would have stood up and said, we don't believe in this and we won't follow this any longer. But no rival faction ever emerged with a leader that could take these people and articulate their thoughts.
So this is one of the most striking of the lost opportunities.
In my mind, yes.
In mine as well, from reading the book. Now, one of the reasons, Pete Daniel, that this segregationist pressure worked so well, and one of the reasons I consider this, as I've said to you, an honest book. Much has been written about segregation, but rarely have I seen the focus on the sexual fears that were played upon like a harp throughout this decades-long period, and as a way of frightening the white population about the prospects of integration. I mean, am I right? That just seemed to me to be major chords in this symphony.
Yes, that's been the theme since the Civil War, at least, and probably before. But as you look through the history of lynching, there's the mythology that lynching was based on rape, which of course has been totally disproved, that many lynchings were simply because a black person had become too successful or who had stood up for his dignity as a human being and was therefore killed. So all through the 50s, the letters I read and all these different collections I used, so many of them had to do with this fear of racial mixing. There was a pollution attached to it. It goes back to these people in the 20s who were writing these big books about the decline of civilization,
right,
and threatening the white race's integrity. And of course, by the time you get to the 50s, there was race was in the South was so blurred that it just didn't matter.
Exactly.
But that fear was so deeply ingrained, and authors such as Lillian Smith wrote these eloquent books exploring that subject. But the letters from the most common people, they were really disturbed. And what I've tried to do in this book is deal with some of the white fears. Instead of dismissing this as totally irrational, trying to get at the basis of what drove these people to have such fears.
Mm-hmm. Let me take a moment from our conversation, Pete, to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Pete Daniel, author of Lost Revolutions, published by the University of North Carolina Press, and due out in April, right, Pete?
Right.
This month. As we mentioned earlier, another of the great foci of this book is on the triumph of Southern culture. As the book, and I love this word, quotes it, low-down culture, the culture of the working class, the culture that was for so many years disesteemed, if that's a word, in the South. And this involves both white and black artists and creators. And it, of course, by culture, we mean it here broadly speaking, music and NASCAR and other manifestations. Now, what happens, Pete, to make a long and extremely interesting story, perhaps somewhat short, is there's a renaissance, isn't there, as these forms begin to get bigger audiences and sort of come to the fore. And you get Elvis Presleys and B.B. Kings and many others, in Memphis in particular, creating and these wonderful cross currents of cultural creation. But I'd love you to comment on all of that, but tell us as you do why all of that ferment also is something of a lost opportunity. I mean, it seems to me there might have been even more coming together or more stances taken by these men and women who were essentially in the same milieu.
I think after World War II, working class people were liberated when they moved off the farms. I call it the last generation of sharecroppers, black and white. And I want to clarify that when I use low-down culture, it is complementary. Mm-hmm. This is to separate it from elite culture, which they had very little use for. They had a thriving way of life. They knew music, they knew how to have fun, and both black and white Southerners were very content to go along without intruding on the elite classes at all. So after the war, these people started moving all over the country. So what happened in Memphis that I deal with was replicated to some extent in many cities throughout the country. It was in Memphis a collision between rural people who brought in one tradition of music and urban people in Memphis who had a very sophisticated background in music. And when that collision happened, you were already at the edge of rhythm and blues was popular.
Right.
And so what happened was the radio stations were playing all kinds of music. And there were jukeboxes that had all kinds of music. People in Memphis were exposed to a wide band of music.
Right.
And when all that music started circulating, there was Sam Phillips, one of the great producers of the 20th century.
Sun Records.
Who opened Sun Records, but it was always Memphis Recording Service. And a whole group of black artists went through there, including B.B. King, and he sold most of those records to other labels. And then he started Sun Studio and recorded, of course, first Elvis Presley among the white artists. And Elvis Presley's songs went out like a beacon. Mm-hmm. We interviewed any number of artists, such as Carl Perkins, who heard it in Jackson, Tennessee. And his wife leaned out of the kitchen and said, "Carl, that sounds like y'all." So he was already playing that kind of music, influenced by Hank Williams and Bob Wills and other people. And so he made a pilgrimage to Sun Studio, just like any number of other of these working-class white musicians, many of them from rural backgrounds. And Sam Phillips knew what to do with them. He knew their culture. He knew their talent. He knew how to bring them into something that they didn't even know they had.
Yeah.
And when that hit the national stage, it was rock and roll. And of course, as I mentioned in the book, Elvis Presley brought different style hints too, because he was a white man who sang music largely influenced by black traditions. He wore clothes usually worn by black men that were bought on Beale Street from Lansky Brothers. And he presented this gigantic figure that had appeal across a wide spectrum.
You know, I discovered Memphis in the 50s through your book. I hadn't visited it in the 50s, but it does seem in many ways like the cultural center of the South. I mean, I don't want to overstate it, but the power of not just Sun Records, but there's another company called Stax Records mentioned here, which I think is a black run company in Memphis at that time.
Stax was started by a white man named Jim Stewart and his sister Estelle Axton. That's where the Stax comes from, right. The last two letters of their last names. And they started a little studio in East Memphis and then moved into the inner city.
Now, they had a lot of black artists then.
And then, they moved into an area that was becoming largely black. And these kids would come in off the street into the record store in the front of the studio. They would hang out. So you have these people from the neighborhood like David Porter and Booker T and others coming in. And you have these white kids from the suburbs who grew up in the eastern suburbs of Memphis coming in. And they make this music.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful, it's a really wonderful story.
It is a wonderful story. And some of the complementary aspects of this story, for example, those concerning stock car racing, are also equally compelling and fascinating. And both of them, and colorful personalities like Junior Johnston and other people who are introducing stock car racing to the country, and it becomes a national passion. Both of the these forms, Pete, in my mind, shared a quality you bring out in this book I thought was pivotal to understanding the, quote, untamed quality of these acts. The fact that these were, well, not to, keep, to put too fine a point on it, but a certain degree of wildness and edginess in the music and the sport. Is that right? Is that why it got such appeal?
I think that the wildness and the untamed nature was extremely appealing. The stock car drivers who came along in those days were from a background of working class, but some of them had hauled liquor and drove very fast cars, very much like the race cars they drove, and outran the law.
Right, and trippers they were called.
Trippers, yeah. And they were tough, and they were crazy. Mm-hmm. And some of the most unique folk we've produced in this country, I think, and most interesting. So they eventually got organized by Bill France, who was one of the founders of NASCAR and who right. became its great leader. And they raced, and they put on a show because they could really drive cars.
When we think of people like the Elvis Presleys, the B.B. Kings, the Junior Johnsons, and so many other truly colorful personalities. Maybe the South produces more colorful people than other regions, or at least it seems that way sometimes. There's something about Southern celebrities I've always found particularly fascinating. But setting that aside for a moment, this is a book rich in personality. There's a lot of first-person testimony throughout all your chapters. And although we have, and I think correctly, focused on some of the more villainous aspects of human behavior and promoting segregation, there are some wonderful pioneers and people who stood up against the tide, so to speak. People like Ella Baker, Lillian Smith, James McBride Dobbs, Dabbs, I do believe. Now, very distinct types. Many others also, I'm glad to say, come through here. But is there any central quality to these very different people? I mean, I'm always fascinated by people who risk not just censure, but physical danger.
Well, if you start with Ella Baker, she was totally fearless. I think she's one of the great people of our century. She was into a lot of things that were very important. She worked for the NAACP in World War II and helped organize. And she always believed that if you could organize the grassroots, that you could really achieve the end of segregation.
Right.
And she went about that. And I've talked to some African-American friends of mine who worked very closely with her. Mm-hmm. And they worshipped her.
Yeah.
Young man just out of college. Mm-hmm. She was a wise woman. She didn't tell them to do things. She sat down and talked with them. Mm. So, and then you have Lillian Smith, who was of the same generation, an author, a woman who took risk and paid an enormous price in the isolation that was forced on her in the 50s. And her voice was stilled pretty much from the public media because she believed in integration. And she couldn't find a platform from which to talk about it.
And then James McBride Dabbs, who I was introduced to in this book, and who had a kind of a poetic streak, if you will. I remember his phrase, let me see if I can quote or remember it, but something to the effect of the South being hit by the winds of change or something like that, which is, but he was willing to represent that change, stand up for it.
Dabbs was an incredible figure in South Carolina. He taught, he farmed, and he was always standing up for integration. And I remember there's one incident in the book where the Farm Bureau is called a meeting and everybody in the county attends the meeting. And the man says, does anybody else want to talk? And Dabbs stands up and says, yes, I want to tell you how ridiculous all this is.
Right.
I mean, and he was shouted down. Yeah. But they said they wanted to hear. And Dabbs says, well, this is what I think. And he was fearless. And he was extremely brave. He and Alice Spearman, who I should mention, a woman who headed the South Carolina Council on Human Relations, a white woman who went through a very interesting career before she ended up in this aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And she also, at great personal risk, tried to keep the black and white people in South Carolina talking, to keep a dialogue going, and it was hard, hard work.
Hard work indeed.
And her life was at risk, too.
Yeah, hard work, and you're right, dangerous work. Indeed. You know, Pete, for anyone who lived through the period, and both of us did, I think it's fair to say that among the few high points, many low points, perhaps two of the lowest were the Emmett Till lynching in 1955, which I certainly will never forget. And I think itself is a kind of emblematic of the sort of philosophical charges you make in the book about the way people were promoting sexual fears at the root of so much of this. The other extraordinary low point, of course, came in 1957, Little Rock, school integration. And the book, in its concluding chapters, has an awful lot about this and the sit-ins and so forth that came about at that period. I want to focus on Little Rock, which I took to be a kind of a example of a conflict that grew and was exploited. And Governor Faubus, to his shame, was central to the exploitation. And there's a phrase in the book called Faubian tactics, sort of an adaptation of Fabian tactics from Roman history, in which, and I thought this was the message of the book in a nutshell, everybody loses.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. And in Little Rock, everyone in the city almost paid an enormous price during this crisis. And the contradiction in all this that always nags at me is that the leaders of the Citizens Council and many of the white segregationists were what we would consider good Christian citizens. And even the head of the Citizens Council in the city was a minister. And how people who were sending missionaries to Africa and Asia could turn around and have the attitude they had toward their black neighbors, it has always confounded me. But in Little Rock, it was really, in my opinion, Governor Faubus's decision to close the school to the black children the day they were supposed to arrive and not comply with the federal orders that made the crisis begin. Mm-hmm. And then a series of blunders and a series of opportunities to end it were not taken advantage of. And so these kids, these nine black kids, bright, some of the best people in the black schools, came over and were totally ostracized. They were never properly introduced to the student body as kids just like them, listened to the same music, tried to dress the same styles, had some of the same interests. They were ostracized. They were not allowed to participate in extracurricular activities. And I don't know how they survived the year. Mm. They were some of the bravest people that we have ever had in this country, in my opinion. And the white kids were given license to beat them, to push them around in the halls, to attack them physically, to say things to them without any fear of being reprimanded. And there were some people reprimanded. But that was a license that these black kids are just there for a few to pick on.
You know, perhaps because, in a sense, although I was in New York State growing up, grew up with that on the television screen and in our lives so vividly, I'll add a personal note and then a postscript from the book that I think is very evocative here, Pete. The personal note is that I remember those kids, and they were my age. And I was later fortunate enough to meet here in Washington Ernest Green. And it's hard for me to think of a prouder moment than shaking his hand and just appreciating what he'd done. The postscript from the book that I found evocative was, I think her name is Brian, maybe Mary Brian.
Hazel
Brian, young white girl who had tormented Elizabeth Eckford, among others. And I think they meet later, don't they?
Yeah, it was even more poignant. Hazel Bryan was a 15-year-old kid who went to school that first day when the nine arrived. And, of course, Elizabeth Eckford wasn't told to meet, and she was isolated and surrounded by a screaming mob as she was walking back to the bus stop. And Hazel Bryan, with her friends and all, joined in the crowd, and she admitted, I interviewed her, she said she didn't know what was going on. She was a kid of 15, more interested in dating and having a good time, but she was wrapped up in the crowd spirit. And a life photographer snapped her picture screaming at Elizabeth Eckford. And her life since then almost has been dedicated to proving that you can't judge me by that photograph.
That's wonderful.
And she has made friends with Elizabeth Eckford. They've won a prize, a humanities prize, because they are friends. But the point I make is that in 1957, there was no space for such a friendship. The white kids were tormented if they showed any friendship mm-hmm. toward the blacks. But that's part of the lost opportunities,
yeah.
that they really had a lot in common and could have been friends. But as it turned out, there was no space for that.
Pete, as we come to the conclusion of our conversation, which I've enjoyed as much as I've enjoyed the book, and you know that's quite a bit, I want to ask you this question, because I read the book not as a Southerner, but certainly as an American, as a witness, if not a direct participant in much that went on. And one of the things that I concluded with as the book came to its own conclusion was that no American should read this book, but no American should read it with complacency or feel that this benighted region somehow got off on its own weird, peculiar, cruel track and had to be redirected. There's a lot, of course, of truth in that, but I guess the question is this. Is there an American message here, one that really tells us a lot about this entire society and its conduct of racial affairs, racial matters historically?
Well, I wish I could put it in a nutshell. I think that what I found was that there was an opportunity, and the South lacked leadership among the white people, the white politicians, and the white clergy, and the white newspaper people. That is, they could have united and fought for justice. It's not like it was something radical and un-American that they could have done. They could have fought for justice for all Americans. And they missed that opportunity. And it would take brave leadership, someone to step forward and take a lot of risks. And a lot of people, of course, in the book did take enormous risks. But the politicians who should have been in the forefront were sulking in the background and trying to figure out how to preserve segregation. I think that translates into our whole history about facing our problems. Because, as you know, we still have problems that revolve around the color line. And we haven't been very brave in a lot of cases in facing those problems. And we always need leadership that can articulate those problems and suggest answers to them. So I think the book raises those questions by exploring people's lives and the lost opportunities they had to take leadership. And I think you can read what brave action would be in the present.
What a wonderful chance we all have to read this book in an electoral season when we can start thinking about what leadership in the society should mean. So for that too, Pete Daniel, I thank you very, very much. And I won't mince words. Lost Revolutions should be read. Thank you.
Thank you.